No one could explain to me. Why, for instance, would a man stand still while he was speared in the thigh? Why would the loser of a fight be set upon by a crowd of women, and then do nothing to defend himself from their fists and feet? Why this? Why that? I'd already exhausted everyone's goodwill. Smiles and apologies do not buy love. To hell with it. I returned to my residence, concerned mostly with petrol and how to get it. I was not at all pleased to find Cricket Carter in the driver's seat, smoking nonchalantly, waiting for me, of course. "You've got yourself a new job, I see." I was in no mood for a lecture. "You'll keep you busy, mate." I asked him who he meant. "You're the chauffeur, mate. Swimming, shooting. They're going to love you now. How much did you pay to get this car fixed?" "£60 to get me out of here. I would have paid 200. "Your predecessor had a combi van. He spent all his pay on petrol, poor bugger. They drove him mad, mate, literally." He held my eye until I looked away. "You know how much petrol costs up here?" I didn't care. He supplied the number anyway. He smiled and ground his cigarette on the steering column and came to stand beside me. "They're playing you, mate." "I know." "Ah." I thought, "Ah, what?" "The missus has been worrying about you. What are you eating? You used to come to tea." I didn't want to wear out my welcome. "Don't buy that martyr bullshit. You're a white man, mate, no matter what you think." "What would that be?" "Ah, come on, Billy. Everybody knows the story now. Give the camp a rest, eh?" "I am." "What happened with your limpy mate? I thought you were going to come to blows." "Nothing." The hateful fellow gazed down at his biceps and his pack of cigarettes, secured by a rolled-up sleeve. "Then come to tea." He was my sole possible source of petroleum, and therefore, arguably, the most important person in my life. So, of course, I went, and was much relieved to find there was company. First, a policeman. That was Buster Thorpe, who had arrived with mules and horses and a boy, who was presently down at the camp. They were about to make a 700-mile ride over the King Leopold Ranges. In addition, there were three young jackaroos, white boys, of course, and the rather rattled pilot of the Dakota, who had been stranded by a Derby willy-willy. The policeman had noticed the Red X Peugeot, and I left it to Carter to explain how it was there, abandoned, and to quiz the policeman about its legal status. When it was established that the vehicle could not be legally driven on a public road, Carter stared at me significantly. Did he know what I was up to? Frankly, I didn't care what he thought. I would depart in darkness, and if the Peugeot served only to get me arrested, it would have served its purpose. Buster Thorpe had a policeman's normal animus towards the Red X crews, who he described as hoons. I frowned and laughed when it was expected. I felt Alice look at me from the curtained doorway. She brought me food. Until this evening, Carter had never said a single word about the Red X. This was only remarkable because he was a great source of Southern sporting news, which he garnered from his pedal wireless, QED, Quamby Downs. Buster Thorpe told stories about the Red X cars, their foolish speed through country towns, and about Dangerous Dan, whom it was clear he'd never met. Dan had blown up a showground dunny with a man inside, or so he said. Mrs. Carter worried that someone might be killed. Young Gwynne chose that moment to introduce Mr. Red X to the visitors. Had he heard of Red X from his dad? I doubt it. Perhaps it was in response to some private storm, or the simple wish to see the visitors marvel that Quamby Downs should be home to a celebrity. "He won!" he cried, blushing so intensely you could see his red scalp shining through his hair. I thought, by golly, is it possible? "One what?" asked the massive Buster Thorpe. "One?" cried Carter, rising, holding a large beer bottle high, while he counted off the empty glasses as he filled them. "One, two," he said, "and three, and four for you, and none," he said to me, "none for you, you wowser." Mrs. Carter showed me her sweet gums and nodded. So the small-town Bobbseys were national champions. The Carters must have known for weeks.
"You mean car number 92? I asked the boy. "Bob's Motors?"
"You won." "Go wash your hands," Carter told his son. "Go on, hurry up."
QED, I thought.
God bless bright-faced Mrs. Bobbsey, in her overalls, with her singlet showing. She had kissed my neck all night.
Chapter 13. "Oh, Mrs. Bobbs, where is your lovely husband?" So said the airline hostess as she led me to my seat. "What a bag of tricks he is," they said, checking out my swollen eyes. "Mrs. Bobbs, you must be proud. Of course, the kiddies must miss their mum," they said. "What a shame you couldn't stay in Sydney for the fun." "Can you trust him, Mrs. Bobbs?" they said, nudge, wink. And I know they'd seen the photograph in that morning's Telegraph. Titch Bobbs at Checkers Club, his face between the breasts of the so-called exotic dancer. Winner take all. And I was there when it was taken, at the table, not even included in the photograph of the support team, Arthur Dunstan, formerly of General Motors, Mr. F. Green, a well-known racing identity, and Mr. Joe Thacker, who now gave his occupation as motel proprietor of Ballarat. I had ridden on the roof of the Holden, waving to the crowds on Parramatta Road, but I ended up in the hotel room, on the telephone talking to my children. I should say daughter. Ronnie was locked in the laundry, playing with the cat. I was proud to have given my husband what he wanted. He was happy. He was over the moon. There was no one who could know it had been a nightmare. The general public banging on the car, taking our windscreen wipers, souvenir of the 1954 Red X trial. It was not a race, but there was a checkered flag, and Titch climbed out the driver's window, what a circus, and joined me on the roof, where he publicly performed his red scarf trick. I grinned until my face was aching. "Winner had something up his sleeve." You can see him in the photos, stamping on the roof beside his gormless wife. I had bought a special dress from Gowings. It was a la Travia, they said. Bright red with a fitted bodice and straps around the neck, and pushy uppy bosom. There was a great knees up at Checkers. You can say I was stupid to leave early. I said it was the kids, but I would not grin like a ninny while he was a dirty flirt. In the hotel room I cried and cried. Dunstan Green delivered him back to our hotel room at 4 in the morning, covered with lipstick and smelling like a barroom floor. And he was the one in a rage. Imagine, I had made a fool of him. The airline hostess offered tea and biscuits, but I turned my back, ashamed to be this wretched, sniffling thing when I had been, so short a time before, a heroine, down there with wheels on fire, driving through those snowy mountains with no brakes. Nervous Nellie had never been in an airplane before, and now she was frightened of the bumpy plane, a Vickers Viscount, same as the one that crashed in Hobart on Christmas Day. I should have stayed at the dinner until the end. I should have stayed sitting between Green and Dunstan and shoved my chest out. But I was too busy being betrayed. We landed at Essendon Aerodrome, a dark paddock and two taxis sitting in the rain. The first driver was outraged that I would ask him to drive 30 miles to Bacchus Marsh. He'd never get a fare back. He'd miss his tea. The second fellow was no better.
"Where?"
"Bacchus Marsh."
"Oh, I don't know about that."
"It's not as if I'm going to have a baby in the back."
How cruel the world seemed. How pathetic I'd let myself become, standing in the headlights. I crawled into the back seat and wept.
Are you all right, love?
He asked. How could I explain or justify myself? I said my husband had died, and then I howled as if he really had. Howled and snotted and blew my nose all the way down to Rockbank, past Dan's garage. We came into the marsh through the Avenue of Honour. I got out at Lurdaderg Street, at the sale yards where I breathed the damp, cold air of my real life. It smelled of mud and panicked cattle, and I thought of dear, decent Willie Buckhuber, with his wheelbarrow and his shovel. And I saw our lighted windows, but I passed them and ran my fingers along next door's rain-wet privet hedge. Willie was back home, of course. He must be by now. I felt it in my bones. So gently, gently, I lifted the latch on his rusting gate. Slowly, so as not to make a noise, I swung it open. I was smiling, a real smile. His wet, unopened letters lay on the floor of his front veranda, white as bones. I knocked cautiously at first, and then could not hide my feelings anymore.
Chapter 14. Written confirmation of Bob's Motors Red X victory reached me courtesy of Alice, who retrieved the Melbourne papers from the big house garbage and delivered them directly to my kitchen table, where she smoothed out the crumpled pages and, with her intelligent face made sweet with mischief, went through the stories and the captions to learn each individual's connection to me. I made her sugary tea, and she touched the photographs and then my face. It would not be false to say we shared a kind of love. We were certainly joined by mutual feelings about Carter, who was plenty jealous of me. But she would be growled if she stayed, so she sighed and stood, and I walked her to my gate. There I waited until I heard the dogs heralding her arrival at the camp. It was a sweaty night, and I was alone again, watching the insects committing suicide against the kitchen lamp. I had picked up that awful opera book when I heard a step on my front veranda. A moment later, three visitors filed into my house. Dr. Battery, Crowbar, skinny, dusty-haired Tom Taylor in his waistcoat and tie. As they entered, I saw each one held two flagons, emptied of fortified wine and filled with a clear, reddish liquid, which must be petrol. Molotov, I thought. I had some rattan chairs, but Dr. Battery, as usual, was more comfortable on the floor, and I followed his example. Then, for the first time, I was introduced by name to Tom Taylor, that same intense presence who had for so many nights caused the punker to stir the air above my pink-sculpted head. Now he took my hand, and I was surprised that the glaring man had such a gentle and unexpectedly adaptive grip. Apart from his two explosive flagons, the punkawalla had brought a small Hessian bag, which, as he began whispering and making signs to Dr. Battery, he gently laid aside. As blacks were forbidden to visit the quarters of the whites, this deputation clearly had a serious purpose, one that kept the men huddled in a conference wherein there was much coughing and clearing of throats. Dr. Battery, being most senior, began speaking, for the most part, in schoolroom English. He said that although they had given me the car, they were all agreed it was not for me to pinch it. Further, he said, I was obliged to remain in my country where I belonged. No, you don't, I thought. Crowbar was perhaps less confrontational. He said that I could now be taught certain secret lore. Tom the Punkawalla said nothing. I assumed he had no English. As for me, I had a few pigeon phrases, words for earth, fire, good, bad, food, sit down, come here.
I nodded to him, but he remained aloof, and I finally saw this was the start of a negotiation. They would offer something and take something away, the latter being the car my future life depended on. I showed them that I knew the value of what they were offering to give. I said I was honoured that they planned to instruct me. The three of us, I said, were joined by lines of blood, but I, been growed up without instruction in the law. Them welfare fellas, it made me a proper white fella. My position was such that I was too bugger up to receive instruction in the law, i.e. their part of the bargain was no use. Crowbar then spoke to the Punkawalla, and I saw by the repetition of certain words he was translating my speech. I was alarmed to see the fierce little fellow laugh, and then speak rapidly, looking directly at me. I suspect that this had been very tough talk before it was reissued from Crowbar's lips. In translation, he said that when the Punkawalla was a boy, he did law business, and the world would last forever. Now the world would die. He was sorry I now had to hear what he must tell me. Long time ago, welfare had arrived in a utility truck with a cage on the back, like you might use for stock. The Punkawalla had been maybe 5 years old. His mother told him, "Run, run, run." He ran to his father, who threw dust at him, and told him to go, 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 piss off. He headed into the Spinifex, but the welfare caught him and threw him in that cage. They took him to an orphanage in Derby. All the way he hollered, "Where was his mother? Where was his father?" At the orphanage they sprayed poison on him and stole his clothes. He lived in that place a long time without his people. Then the orphanage closed down and the welfare took him to foster parents. The foster mother took them to a big room with a bed. He never saw anything like it in all his life. Even the welfare seemed surprised. It was for a king. Then the welfare left and the foster mother said, "Come with me." And she took him to a little caravan in the backyard full of weeds. She used to grow leprosy, he thought. Maybe syphilis and other bad things. That night a man came to the caravan. There are records of what he did to the little fellow, Crowbar said, looking at the floor. Night after night. It is written down in the judges' books, kept in Sydney or in Big London or some place. Those books never did anyone no good. Did I understand? He had been used and raped, night after night, until they shifted him to another orphanage. He was already finished then. When he fought them, he was whipped. When he ran away, he was starved. When he left school, he was a drunk in Derby, and then he was a drunk in Mardawarra. He was in jail and out of jail until he finally found his mother. But he had lost her language, and all he had was mongrel talk. I had to stay at Quambi Downs, he wanted me to know. I was not too old for law, the translator said. The old law was forgotten by the young fellas. He was the boss of a new law. He would teach me that, but he would need the car. You scoundrel, I thought. I was a reader of Oceania. I had read Ted Strelo, and therefore understood new law was impossible. Away he goes. The thoroughness of their Aboriginal forefathers has left to them not a single unoccupied scene which they could fill with creatures of their own imagination. Tradition and the tyranny of the old men in the religious and cultural sphere have effectively stifled all creative impulse, and no external stimulus ever reached Central Australia which could have freed the natives from these insidious bonds. It is almost certain that native myths had ceased to be invented many centuries ago. They are, in many ways, not so much a primitive as a decadent race. "There is no new law," said the king of quiz shows. "He say we're all bugger up," Crowbar said. "He show you now." The Punkawalla removed his tie and waistcoat and revealed damage that made my own shoulder injury look like a mosquito bite. His glistening back bore the marks of a greenhide whip, crisscrossed, raised,
woven into his skin. I was appalled, of course, and grateful when he covered himself. "You teach them kids," he said quietly, as he slipped his shirt back on. "I teach you new law. You be learning from the boss."
"He no cut your cock," Dr. Battery assured me. "His law don't cut. He paint him on you. No blood."
"It is book law, Billy," grinned Crowbar. "You can read it, Uncle Red X. New law." I was shocked by the evidence of torture, but it did not weaken my desire to keep my car. They wished to steal it from me. Their claim to having new law must be made up to serve this end. I asked them where this new law came from. If it was a book, it must be the Christian Bible.
"Out of ground," said Tom Taylor.
"Who give you?"
"Kalsh."
Later, I would learn the name Kalsh was that of the esteemed anthropologist Arthur Christian Kalsh. Bringing in the academics was more than I had bargained for, but I would not be bullied about the car, which was, obviously, mine by right. Besides, I was not such a fool as to involve myself in any secret knowledge, the possession of which might easily place my life in danger. Crowbar uncorked a flagon of petrol.
"Smell," he said.
"You help us, Bill," said Battery, his expression becoming rather soft and thoughtful. "We help you. This is best for you."
"We show you country, Billy. We still go hunting."
I pointed out that they would need far more petrol than these flagons.
"You give money," Crowbar said sweetly. "We find you plenty petrol."
Whatever bargain I had made appeared to be a slippery one. I gave them £18, which was all I had. Then, when we had all shaken hands, I turned off the lamps so the conspirators could leave in darkness. I sat out on the veranda listening to a normal night at Quambie Downs, the discord of the camp, the insistent drone of Carter's pedal radio. Dogs barked, an owl cried. I made out another black figure at my gate. It was Alice, who had returned to tell me that Tom Taylor was a very bad man. Bad man for everyone, Christians, old fellows. His law no good. He crazy. Then she kneeled, and I saw that I was to kneel with her. "Our Father," she said, "who art in heaven." Alone again, I set up the kerosene lamp, and it was then that I discovered, abandoned on the floor, the sugar bag the punkawalla had brought with him. Having seen how careful he was with it, I knew this was not due to absent-mindedness. He intended me to see the contents. A substantial bark wallet, decorated with white patterning and tied with what was certainly human hair. Inside the wallet I found a book, not a Christian Bible, but something thinner, puffed, bleeding, water-damaged, which I finally understood, beneath its artful ink and ochre decoration, to be Oceania number 43, October 1952. Here, by means of frequent ochre markings, my attention was quickly drawn to Nativist Movements in the Western Kimberley by Arthur Christian Kalsh, a learned paper frequently naming a certain Tom the Tailor. I was, to say the least, intrigued.
Chapter 15.
While anthropologists might frown on the practice or deny the very possibility, I cannot believe this is the first and only time the subject of an anthropological study saw the final published paper, or that the recipient of Oceania number 43, like anyone living a quotidian life, was not affected by the sight of his name in print. Tom the Tailor was certainly Tom Taylor, or the Punkawalla. The thrust of the paper confirmed that he certainly had a new law,
and this was occasion, in the writer's view, for considerable amazement, i.e. final proof that Aboriginal Australians were no different from other peoples who had suffered from colonial oppression. Few societies under foreign domination accept that position in silence. Objections are indicated in a collectively anti-colonial mood and in more specific movements of emancipation. The article in Oceania showed how certain survivors in the West Kimberley had raided the Christian Bible, taken possession of Noah's Ark, and turned it into an instrument of resistance against the white oppressors. I don't know if it might be called a cult, a law, or a religion, but it was certainly in a book. It was ancestral beings, I learned in Oceania, who had appeared to Tom the Tailor and given him this ark. It was on no whitefella map, but was said to be somewhere near the old trade routes beyond Mardawarra. In its hold were gold and jewels and crystals. The former mission tailor had declared himself the boss of the law of the ark, which said a mighty rain would come to flood his country, that it would be a rain of holy water, which would make the skins of blackfellas turn white. The blackfellas would be ready for the deluge, and they would climb aboard the ark, and all the Katia would drown. This ark was not a made-up story. It was attested to by sacred boards. It was a real ark in a real place, and it was a secret, so dangerous that if you saw it accidentally, you must be killed. As he was not a popular figure in the camp, I doubted the Punkawalla had many followers. Just the same, he possessed a certain malevolent power, and I was not pleased to find myself the object of his will. Dr. Battery had a bad eye, but the other one was good, and he was respected for his marksmanship, always returning to the camp with tucker for those whose totem forbade them to eat kangaroo. All he needed was a car to take him shooting in the bush. He could drive himself, as he often said, which was why I kept the distributor rotor in my pocket, so my precious getaway was safe in my control. Crowbar also hunted, but, more importantly, he was a father of four girls, and thus had his own uses for my car. The other teacher, my poor predecessor, had driven girls and boys to the 15 mile, where there was a reliable swimming hole, even in the dry. As the weather had become unbearably hot, I had followed his Volkswagen tracks to water, and you would never guess how many pupils I fitted into that Peugeot. 15 inside and more on the roof rack. During those happy days, I would be quite astonished to see what my life had become. Faster, faster, Uncle Red X! Those bare feet hanging over the windscreen and over the side. As long as I lived at Quamby Downs, there was no escape from this responsibility. Carter eked out petrol for us, and sometimes it was a gift, and sometimes he charged me on my store account. But it was never more than 4 or 5 gallons, not enough for me to do a bunk. As a result, we were forever running out, and filth was then sucked from the tank into the carburetor miles from home, and the next week's work would all centre on getting the vehicle back to life, transporting Dr. Battery and petrol and a plastic basin in which to wash the parts. I was only one of many servants to the cause. I had never had so satisfying a class in all my life, which does not mean that I stopped preparing for my escape, collecting my own bottles and flagons of petrol, stashing them behind a stack of timber offcuts in the storeroom where Alice, on some professional mission of her own, discovered them. She took my hand and led me to my stash, and for once I could not make her smile, no matter how I clowned for her. She worried what might be done to me as punishment for being complicitous in Tom Taylor's bad business. As for that particular business, I am still not at liberty to disclose any more than what is publicly known, but I did discover, in my own classroom, more evidence of the resistance that white anthropologists had hitherto denied. This came from my shyest pupil, Charlie Hobbs. Charlie was small and sleek and delicate, with large dark eyes, and, while generally displaying the most anxious disposition, had it in his power to lift your heart with his lovely smile. He chose to sit furthest from the front, closest to the outside, the hottest part of the room, but the one from which he might effect a fast escape, and where he had sat on a particular morning, with Oliver Emu close on one side and Susie Shuttle on the other. Charlie had come to the station with his father, who had been employed on the company's other property. The story he brought into our classroom was like a leaf that had blown hundreds of miles from its source at Victoria Downs, where Charlie's family were descendants of survivors of a massacre. He was one of those of whom Carter said, "He gives no trouble." His voice was quiet as moth wings, and I could not hear a single word he said. It was calm, barrel-chested Susie Shuttle whose ear he spoke into, and Susie Shuttle, who repeated every word in a good, strong voice, doing him the honour I never heard her grant another child. I mean, she did not correct his English, or attempt to make his Captain Cook comply with the historical record, which would have kept the Englishman skulking around the coast. She enlivened Charlie's injured whisper with sarcasm and indignation and many other registers which never survived the class transcription, but are horribly easy to imagine as you read. "Captain Cook come out from Big England. He got to Sydney. He get all the books from London, Big England. Bring a lot of men, lot of horse, rifle, bullock. Ah, this nice country. You got fish here?" "Yes, we got plenty fish, kangaroo, everything." Captain Cook look around. "Very pretty country. Any more people around here?" "Oh, yes, there's a mob in the bush looking for a bit of fish and tucker. A lot of food old people get easy." "Captain Cook got a big ship. He got a jetty. He rolled down guns and he'd been shooting there for maybe 3 weeks, shooting all the people. Women get shot. Kids get knocked out. Then he packs up his gear and gets back in his boat to go up around Australia. Goes in this pocket there. Big mob of Aboriginal people by this bay. This wee country, we never look at white fella come through here. We can be ready for you. Get a big mob spear." Captain Cook put the bullet in his magazine. Start to shooting people, same like Sydney. "Really beautiful country," Captain Cook reckoned. "That's why I'm cleaning up people. Take it away." Captain Cook followed the sea right around. "I'd like to put my building there. I'd like to put my horses there." Captain Cook been send them over shooting lot of people. Horses been galloping all over Australia, hunting all those people. Still people been running away, still. Can't catch up. Horse can't gallop in over rough places or them caves." "That's right. We've been ready for white fellas, all right. Our people been really, really cranky. They don't want white people here. Hit 'em with a spear. Kill 'em. They been fight white fella. They been have a spear and white fella been have rifle. If white fellow been come up, got no bit of a gun, couldn't have been rounding 'em up, killing all the people. They never been give 'em fair go." Captain Cook reckons, "This no more blackfella country, belong to me fella." He said, "I'm going to put my place, anywhere I can put him. Him bin bring lot of book from Big England, right here now." They got that book for Captain Cook from England, and that's his law. Book belong to Captain Cook, that means all belong to Captain Cook. The old people really frightened for the white people coming from Big England. And they've been really, really sad, poor buggers. "Anybody sick? Anybody sick in the guts or in the head?" Captain Cook orders. "Don't give him medicine. When they get in crook, old people, you kill 'em him first. When they on the job, that's right. You can have them on the job, but don't pay 'em him. Let him work for free. Any children come round, you can have the stockman kill 'em. We'll still hold that, people, and don't let 'em go. Any man come sick, boy, anything like that. Blind man, don't give him medicine.
You take him in a dry gully and knock him.
Susie Shuttle touched Charlie's little hand and whispered in his ear. And after that, she said, and Dr. Battery's grandson wrote, "Women, women, got a bit of baby. Don't let him grow that baby. Just kill that baby." Charlie was shaking now. Anyone could see that the carcass of his history was just too big for his skinny body, and he began to weep. And Susie Shuttle and Oliver Emu wept with him, and my entire class became very silent, and I was frightened of what I had done, but also emotional and angry, and I promised them that I would do all I could do, that I would begin now and not stop, no matter how long it took, until I had completely inscribed the entire saga on the wall. I was not thinking about Cricket Carter or the Western Australia Education Department. I was not thinking of anything but my own rage. And so, blinded by self-righteousness, I had completely forgotten that I had inscribed Captain Cook 1770, and that it now lay hidden like a landmine beneath the calcimine. Chapter 16. A letter from Sebastian Lasky, appraiser, rare books, maps, early manuscripts, 26 Glenhaven Court, Box Hill, Victoria. Telephone BW 9628. Dear Willy Willy, Oceania, dubbed with blood and ochre, will blow me down. What would our favourite collection manager do to get his gloved hands on that votive object? I assume it is now beyond his reach, and your reach too, which is probably just as well. You have shown an amazing talent for finding trouble. I write trouble, thinking not of Adelina or your son, although they can never be absent from my mind, but of our recent visit to your rentier in Bacchus Marsh, who we found in a state of great anxiety about your arrears. He had already advertised your house, vacant possession, and was beside himself with relief when Dorothea and I arrived to remove your library. He seemed a decent enough chap for a rentier, but he did find it necessary to twice remind me that we would be paid nothing for our work. At the same time, he stressed that he lacked the legal authority to grant me possession of your goods and chattels. He resolved this by cleverly deciding that we had come as prospective tenants, and that he would leave the keys on his desk for us to make our own inspection. Having said that, he typed up a permission to inspect and signed it, and we drove up the hill to Lerdeburg Street, presumably intent on larceny. He had given us due warning of the condition of your kitchen, which seemed to me, if not Dorothea, what one would expect of a desperado in your circumstances. In any case, we were bibliophiles, not kitchen maids, and it was your library we had come for, after all. To this end we had brought with us he who was to inherit it from you, young Neil. Dorothea had thought this a psychologically ill-conceived idea, but Adelina had already told the little fellow what we were to do, and then he could talk of nothing else but you, his father, and where you had lived, and all the books that would now be his to read or sell as he thought fit. I thought this normal, Dorothea peculiar. He's only 6, but having spent many Saturdays at his mother's table at the South Melbourne market, is no slouch in the selling department. Your wife, as I'm sure you have reason to know, has a rare eye, and that cluttered table has always yielded treasure each time we have visited. We never bought from pity, as she clearly thought we did, but from amazement that such art nouveau might be found so far from Europe. In any case, there's little doubt that your books will soon find their way to that table and there serve a useful purpose. It was the thought of his inheritance that had the little fellow so bright and jumpy in the rentier's dank office,
and that gentleman, for his part, could not take his eyes off the black child, the very first he'd seen, so he told me, sotto voce. Dorothea was irate, but very quiet through all of this, standing close beside Neil with her hand on his level little shoulder, clearly imagining some great racist damage would be done to him. But it was not so at all. Once we were inside your residence, it was as sweet as Christmas morning. What fun to hear his smart questions about the bindings, for instance. How, I wondered, can a boy love his father via the medium of a dusty book? Well, he can and does. He was also strangely curious about the value of his inheritance, and I soon had to declare a ban on all estimates until the books were back in St. Kilda. Dorothea, of course, continually prevented me from exerting myself as if a box of books would cause a second stroke. That was patent nonsense, although I must admit to being a less effective machine than previously. We were in the middle of our work when I had a new reason to reflect on your talent for finding trouble. For we were set on by a pert little creature, by no means unattractive, even if she was dressed for a square dance. This was Mrs. from next door, demanding to know who we thought we were. When we declared ourselves your servants, she as good as called us liars and demanded proof, which we obviously could not supply. You were returning home to Bacchus Marsh, she said, as fervent as a Christian. I said our information was quite otherwise, and it then became embarrassingly clear from her tremor that you had formed some intimate alliance with her. Dorothea kicked my ankle, and what could I do but insist on the veracity of my statement? Your neighbour left in distress, and there was nothing for it but to fill the little van with books. I stood guard in the street, waiting to explain myself to the police. Instead, the next-door missus returned, red-eyed and contrite, carrying a pot of tea and cups and milk and biscuits on a tray which she set down on the front veranda. It was then Neil saw her, and it seemed he had met her in Melbourne, and she was a Red X driver, and you, good grief, had been a navigator. As far as we had known, you could not even drive, so we were gobsmacked by this new persona, and then further surprised that the pert missus was previously familiar with Neil and Adelina and the noble Madison. Seeing all of these connections, I thought there could be no harm in giving her what she craved, your address in Quamby Downs. Now my ankles are bruised blue, and I am informed by my wife that I am a grand old fool, but I hardly think it likely your admirer will come knocking on your door. Dorothea, who is very concerned for you, sends you a frowning sort of love. I have rescued a few Oceanias from your very sneezy house, and seeing you are caught in a new craze, will send them to you, together with some of A.B. Patterson's doggerel, which will say better than I can that we miss you very much. I had written him a letter which I had, for want of better knowledge, sent to where I met him down the Lachlan, years ago. He was shearing when I knew him, so I sent the letter to him, just on spec, addressed as follows, Clancy of the Overflow. And an answer came directed in a writing unexpected, and I think the same was written in a thumbnail dipped in tar. 'Twas his shearing mate who wrote it, and verbatim I will quote it. Clancy's gone to Queensland droving, and we don't know where he are. Sebastian.
Chapter 17. In Bacchus Marsh, the nights turned hot. The fire brigade became busy. It being almost Christmas, pine saplings were tied to veranda posts of the courthouse hotel. The courthouse introduced a bargain counter lunch, T-bone for 5 shillings, and I was happy being spared the job of cooking for Titch and his associates. It was in this pub, supposedly, that Titch hatched the plan for buying a Federal Tire discount. This deal stank of Thacker, Green and Dunstan, and all those blowflies who had descended on our life. Left to himself, Titch would be content to be a dealer with a franchise. The syndicate had made big money on their bet, although the actual amount of winnings went up and down, according to the beer or the moon or the tides at Ocean Grove. Izzy Green patted my hand and said I was a nervous little mouse. After that, I shut my trap and did my best to make sure the Bacchus Marsh business survived all this fame and fortune. Many afternoons, there was no one but me on the showroom floor. Of course, the customers did not expect to find a woman. Sometimes they could not see me. They asked to see a salesman, and I said that was me, and often they were deaf. This proved difficult for all concerned, but I had a nice smile and I began wearing skirts, and if I could get a cup of tea into their hand, they would have time to learn I knew my onions. I never contradicted or argued. I never said it was me, Mrs. Bobs, who had been the co-winner of the Red X trial. 9 times out of 10, I would take the vehicle around to the prospect's house after tea, so your missus can try it on for size. Sometimes the house was on a potato farm at Bullingarook, and then I took the kids as well. I was no Titch, but I was no slouch. My husband was generous enough to say so, and I liked the praise. I also liked how busy I became, for the new demands of life took my mind off certain disappointments. I was almost 30, and of course the honeymoon was over. Alas, the more capable I became, the more my husband felt free to be away. I never thought life would be a fairy tale. The trussed-up pine saplings wilted and lost their needles. The syndicate formed a proprietary limited company to buy the chain of tire stores with 5 outlets in the Melbourne suburbs. Mr. Green explained that the mortgage was self-financing, whatever that meant. He had just made a fortune when Rising Fast failed to win at Flemington, but I was not convinced. I was waiting for a crash that didn't seem to come. But finally, what the hell? I let Titch hire an office manager who had been a teller at the National Bank. 1 week later, he decided the new man was useless, but he still felt free to leave him in the office and go speedboat racing on Port Phillip Bay. Allegedly, this was business-related, being filled with Red X contenders like Jack Murray and Jack Davey. Why should I complain? Bob's tires had 30-second spots on 3UZ, the same station as Deezy's radio quiz show. Titch Bobs has something up his sleeve. And there is nothing like a catchy slogan to make you popular at a barbecue, it seems. He practiced magic tricks at night, and it wasn't as if he actually looked like his father, but these performances made him excited, and he got a sort of glint in his eyes and showed a clean, straight line of teeth. I was on the showroom floor one Saturday morning, in no rush to take the order I would clearly get, when Edith telephoned with what she called a emergency. "Can't it wait?" "Up to you," she said. "They're carrying stuff out to a van." The prospect was annoyed, and as I later learned, went straight up to Ballarat and bought a Ford with cash. But I was home in a minute, finding Ronnie in the driveway in his sister's place. How brave he was, coming with me to confront the burglary. And what a wild and woolly lot the burglars were. A pair of bolts, quite obviously. The man's face cut with ugly scars, his body twisted to one side. His wife was small and fierce as a fighting fish. "This is private property," I said, and much else I can't recall, but naturally I was agitated. And the more I heard their cock and bull, the more upset I was, and it was my lovely dear Ronnie who dragged me off the front veranda and back inside, where Edith was too busy with her telephone to make tea for the bolts. "It's Janice," she hissed, meaning Janice Cox, the new best friend. Back on the veranda, the black child had unexpectedly appeared. What did I say to that? "I am Neil," he said, and held out his hand as he had done previously. "Do you remember me?" Yes. The Bolts said they had come for his father's books. I made conversation as if I were a normal woman. I poured them tea and was embarrassed to see my milk curdling. They pretended not to notice, but they did. Ronnie asked Neil had he ever seen a two-tone Cadillac, and Neil said no, and so they went away and returned with the glossy American catalogue originally supplied by Dunstan. As Ronnie had a rough and rowdy side to him, and as he had never seen a black boy in his life, I was pleased to see how attentive he was to his guest. That was when I must have thought it. I mean, feeling kindness ease my pain, seeing them on the dusty hallway floor, backs against the wall, caressing those glossy Cadillacs. The notion that we could have Neil to stay for a weekend. I certainly did not rush into it, as Titch later said. I certainly did not ask the Bolts' opinion, but anyone could see those boys were born to be each other's friend. I was not conniving or meddlesome, the opposite. I tested Ronnie's feelings first, then Edith's. At that stage, she was perfectly amenable. The complaints began after the first weekend. She then said I was embarrassing.
The way you grin and fawn on him. Can you quit it, Mum?
Who had heard of such a thing? A girl being jealous of a boy. But she resented any kindness I showed, big or small. She was outraged that I dared pat his little head, and that I drove all the way to Melbourne to pick him up and then drove him home afterwards.
"Your pet monkey," she said,
and I slapped her, and she would not talk to me for days. And it was not until her father came home that she rejoined the human race, sitting in his lap and tickling him. She was lucky to have a father at all, I told her. This also was a cause of great offence, but I must say I did look forward to those weekends when Adelina sent us Neil Bakhuba, as I thought of him. It was a relief for her, of course, with her husband not really being her husband, and she working 6 days a week and selling bric-a-brac on Sundays. I never honestly thought about the boy's skin colour. Of course it was a shock the first time I met him, but I was more disturbed by his stand-in father, who was black and sissy and smelling pretty, with hands so very soft and dry. In the autumn I was quite often in Melbourne with the two boys, and then I could not help but feel the world's opinion, in the back of a taxi, say, with the driver's eyes on me, thinking his dirty thoughts, imagining what I'd been up to. How many times was I asked where I came from, what age the boys were, and where they went to school? Ronnie was boisterous and bouncy, and Neil was careful and exact, but they were continually amused by each other. What a shame it was that Willie never had a chance to see them looking through his gold-stamped foreign language books. None of this was in my mind when I took that photograph. It was not a very good one anyway, like a million photographs taken with box brownies. Two boys in swimming togs, a grey, paling fence behind them, their arms around each other's shoulders, squinting in the sun. Yes, one was black and one was white, but no one remarked on it when I picked up the Kodak envelope from the chemist shop. Of course, it is well known they look through everything when the pictures are delivered. In any case, what bad thing could they possibly think? I had been up to something, but what? What possibly? I placed the photograph in an envelope and addressed it to Neil's father. He had a right. I was claiming nothing from him. I was not related to the son. Please tell me what is so strange about offering solace to a lonely man.
Chapter 18. I had waited for it, the wet season, through every blistering morning and the heated rocks of afternoon, and still I was not prepared. Not for its density, immensity, the roar upon the roof, the obliteration of all distance, the air sucked from my lungs as if it meant to kill me. This rain was the temperature of blood. It polished the tree trunks until they shone. A billabong appeared from nowhere, right by the camp. It brought the trombone cries of frogs, splashing, laughter.
My cross-cultural scholars ducked and dived and brushed their teeth with broken twigs and arrived clean and shining at their desks. The crossing bridge was said to be in danger. The landscape out my bedroom window was a necklace of islands in swirling, cack-coloured water. I thought of Tom Taylor and his ark. It was at this unlikely time that families began to leave the camp to go about their ceremonies and other law business in their countries. Oliver Emu did not have to go anywhere. This was his country, and he would soon face his initiation. And I saw his silent apprehension and excitement as the days passed.